blessings we ask in Jesus' name.
Amen. All right. Let's just do a little bit of kind of closing out from where we were last week. Last past couple weeks, we talked about kind of this, and it's really one story split over two chapters, but Joshua 3 and 4, parting of the sea. They actually enter into the promised land, the beginning of the fulfillment. Talked a little bit about how that, in so many ways, these stories are mirroring the Exodus stories, but in reverse order. You know, and so like, for instance, you know, here they parted the sea, they go in, and it's meant to resemble the parting of the Red Sea. And then just like, you know, on the opposite side here, in chapter 5 now comes Passover, you know, whereas in Exodus it was the opposite, right? You do Passover, then you part the sea. And so it's just like literally working your way out. And the other thing you meet in chapter 5, where we will get here tonight in a few minutes, but the counterpart to, you know, again, if you're working from the central event, you know, and so here you have the parting of the sea and the parting of the river, and then you have Passover, and you got Passover, and then you've got the burning bush, and here you've got the angel of the Lord, and the same type of thing. Take your shoes off, you. But I mean, these are all meant to be echoing. And so literally what Joshua is getting is the Moses experience in reverse, right? But remember, that's kind of where the book started, was Joshua is the servant of Moses, who must become the servant of the Lord. And so the book is slowly, and God himself has admitted, I'm elevating Joshua, but we're literally doing these stories in reverse order. So it's kind of cool as far as that goes. But one of the things that, and this is really where we kind of stopped last week, but I think it was kind of an important takeaway point as we are reading Joshua as Christians, is, you know, one of the things that came out of, especially chapter 4, as they, you know, this, again, wondrous miracle, the second generation's experience of God's power parting the waters. And that really is God's calling card in the Old Testament, right? The parting of the sea was God's great miracle par excellence, to the point that, you know, even back in chapter 2 of Joshua, when Rahab is talking to the spies about why we're afraid of you, what have they heard? Your God splits seas. That kind of rattles us a little bit. Our gods don't do that kind of stuff. Second generation hasn't seen this. They've only heard the stories. Now they're seeing the stories with their own eyes as God is doing similar things. You know, at Jordan, that flood stage, we talked about that. You know, Jordan normally isn't much of a river. Naaman was impressed with it, and most people wouldn't be. And if you go to Israel, you wouldn't be either. It's not much. But that flood stage, it runs for miles. And so it's really something that God has done here. And so coming out of that, they get a memorial, right? What was the memorial at the end of, or in chapter 4 there? It's kind of where we ran out of time last week. Yeah, 12 stones, and it looks like the idea was actually two piles of stones, right? One you could see, one you couldn't see, because one pile of stones is going to be, is you take, and by the way, where are you taking the stones from? Yeah, the river bottom, you know, as a way of just kind of, you know, where, you know, not just the stones exist, but where did these come from? These came from a place you don't normally get them from. And so you put 12 stones on shore, and apparently 12 stones in the river as well. And of course, 12, we get the significance of 12 tribes. And there in chapter 4, it's kind of important. Verse 21. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know. Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea. Again, meant to parallel each other. Which he dried for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of Yahweh is mighty, and that you may fear Yahweh your God forever. And so it wasn't just for that initial generation who didn't get to see God's original miracle, but kind of gets their own version of it. It's meant to be an ongoing talking point. And this illustrates something important for us about what it means to be the people of God. First of all, remember, and this is kind of, again, we mentioned this last week, but just for those of you who weren't here, or it's been a week, you slept, you forgot. Do Christians have similar memorials, God-ordained memorials today? And the correct answer is yes. And there are at least two of them I can think of in particular in the New Testament. What are they? The Lord's Supper, that's the obvious one, right? We do that every Sunday. We do the Lord's Supper, and we will gather on the table, and we will tell the story in some way, shape, or form of what we are doing. That this is not just, you know, this is not just merely bread and grape juice, just like these aren't merely rocks, but there's a story behind how we got to this point and what these things mean. And so we tell the story. What's the other one?
Baptism.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. Yeah, baptism. And is baptism a storytelling as well? According to Paul, it is, right? You know, I mean, you can look at it in one way in terms of a transaction. It's where our sins are washed away, and that's true. But Paul also says it is a reenactment of the actual death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, so that the act itself is an acting out of the Jesus story, right? And so we get that. Both of these in some ways then memorialize crucial aspects of what it means to be a Christian. And why that matters is this. When it comes to passing on the faith to our children, those of us who are parents, those of us who are grandparents, here's the thing you got to understand. Being a Christian, just like being an Israelite in the Old Testament, is not simply a matter of doing the right thing. It's not simply a matter of being moral. It's a matter of acknowledging what God has done as actually having happened in the past. Some of you, you know, we talk about this from time to time. I bring this up in other classes, but I think it's a really crucial point. So many of us think that being a Christian is, I don't sleep around, I don't get drunk, I don't lie, I don't steal, you know, finish out the list. But the problem is, could you do that and be a Muslim? Could you do that and be Jewish? Could you do that and be Buddhist? Or some other Eastern? Yeah. So what makes a Christian a Christian? There's got to be something more of it than just, I don't sleep around, I don't get drunk, I don't lie, I don't steal. What makes a Christian, what made an Israelite? What God has done for you, right? What does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 15? If Jesus has not been raised from the dead, what? Your faith is pointless. If the history is not underneath this, if the story is not true, then the morality means nothing. Paul even admits it, so you might as well eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you're going to be dead. So you might as well squeeze whatever enjoyment you can while you can, because if there's no story here. And so part of what we've got to pass on to our kids is not just they shouldn't be sleeping with their girlfriends or getting drunk at parties on the weekends. What we've got to pass on to our kids is the things that God has done. It's always been part of what it means to be the people of God. You go back to the Old Testament as a starting place for that. Multiple places, you know, when God first establishes the Passover, both in Exodus 12, Exodus 13, he anticipates a time when your children come and say, what mean these things? What are you going to do? Tell them don't sleep around and don't get drunk? No. What are you going to do? You're going to tell them what God did to save you from your sins, i.e. deliver you from Egypt in the metaphor of Old Testament Israel, right? Same thing here, Joshua 4. Your sons are going to look at the stone and say, Dad, what does that mean? You tell them not just the moral expectations of God, but you tell them what God has done. I think one of the challenges we have, and maybe sometimes why our young people struggle a little bit in making their faith their own, is we've impressed morality, but the morality doesn't make sense. There's not a motivation if you really don't believe that there's a God who does things beyond all that you can ask or even think underneath this. Right? Makes sense? And one other aspect of this is, and this is something the Bible itself demonstrates, is that you will never actually live the moral life the way God intended it if you don't know the story. And again, I can think of no better example, just because it's easy, I think, to see this in the text, but also it's extremely relevant to our own time, than marriage, divorce, and remarriage, when Jesus teaches on this in Matthew 19. You remember, the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, can a man divorce his wife for any reason? And they cite to Jesus Deuteronomy 24, but Moses commanded divorce, and there's some stuff they quoted Jesus from Deuteronomy 24. And so technically, yes, Moses did permit a certificate of divorce, and you know, there were some stipulations, some corollaries, but yes, Moses, as Jesus reminded them, didn't command it, he permitted it. Big difference in word choice there. But how does Jesus help them figure out the right way to read even Deuteronomy 24? Does he give them another command? Not exactly. What does he do? Have you not read the story of the beginning? And if you understand when God made male and female and so forth, is what Jesus is basically saying. If you knew the story itself will answer the question of how we apply what Moses is talking about, right? Because back in the garden, if Eve had wanted to divorce Adam, who's she leaving him for? Uh-huh. And if Adam decides that Eve, despite the fact that she's, you know, eternal at that point, still getting a little baggy or something, you know, wants another woman, where's he going? Right? And so the story itself, in one sense, and the two become one flesh, which means not just a sexual act, but what's the actual fruit of the sexual act? A child. That literally where the two of us have become one flesh in that child. And so God's like, you know, look, if you've read the story, I made a male and female, and I said be fruitful and multiply. You've already got how I feel about this subject. And you can't split a marriage then without doing great violence any more than you can split the child that came as the fruit of the marriage, right? And so here's the whole point. You'll never get morality right if you don't put the story back underneath it. Both in terms of motivation, is there a God who's going to hold me accountable or not? Is there a God who's done these mighty things? But also the stories themselves help me understand who God is and what he's about, which better helps me keep the rules. And one other aspect from daily life that helps drive home this point, those of us who parent kids. You ever have one of your kids play lawyer with you when they're getting in trouble for breaking one of your rules? Yeah. And what's one of the lines, those of us who are parents, those of you who are younger don't have kids yet, but you're more recently on the other side of this conversation, maybe just remember your own recent past. No need to volunteer stories unless you want to. And then we're all ears, and so is the internet. But what do we say to our kids when our kids start to play lawyer with us about a rule, and maybe even they're technically correct, they did find the loophole, but what do we say to them? We say, you know what I meant. And how can we say that to them? Because there's this history that we have, the family story of what we're about as a family and how mom and dad act and think of what our goals and purposes are, that the child should have known just on the basis of our life together, our family story. When I say don't do this or do this, I shouldn't have to go through and list all the I shouldn't have to work overtime to close all the loopholes that are possible. If I've given you the instruction in the light of our family story, you know what I meant. And I think sometimes getting as Christians, you know, setting aside, you know, passing the faith on well to our kids, the story is a crucial part of it, not just the do's and don'ts. But sometimes the reason we don't always do what we should do or see what we ought to see is because we're not living in the story. We're just also looking for the loopholes too. Make sense? Memorials matter because memorials put us back in the story and remind us of the story that we're in and where it's going and what it means and who's really in charge. And it's not me, and it's not my desires, and it's not my wants. So, make sense? Comments, questions, objections, refutations, complaints. There are elders in the room, they'd love to hear them. yes, go ahead, Scott. Yeah. Sure. That's right. We forget that in so many ways, and part of why we live in complicated times is because there's a very real sense in which we as a country are renegotiating what stories we use to make light of who we are and where we're at, how we got here, and where we should go forward, right? And so that is a very big part of the argument in this country right now, is what stories will we use as the master narrative to make sense of ourselves as a people? So yeah, at the end of the day, everybody lives in a story, whether you realize it or not. And you're either aware and wise, or you're being carried along and don't understand, and that's why you get so frustrated and confused. But everybody lives in a story. So, and by the way, that's why, you know, what's funny is, you know, you see this in like Texas every once in a while, when the TEA every few years renegotiates in particular the history curriculum in public schools. Boy, is that a hot, you know, everybody thinks, you know, history is a boring subject. It's where they put the football coaches because nobody cares. But the funny thing is, I'm serious, I actually saw one time at Klein ISD advertising, they were looking for social studies teachers for high school, and there was social studies / coach. I'm just saying. So that's the thing, and most of us chuckle because let's be honest, how many of us, history was our favorite class in high school? Oh, okay. Yeah, you're my favorite, Rebecca. I was a little history buff too, but okay, yeah, so there's a few, yeah, that's right. No shame, hold them high. But generally speaking, we're very lonely now, aren't we, too? We're feeling awkward because like everyone else is looking and saying, oh. But But here's the thing, it is, you know, in one sense, it is a forgotten and not taken seriously subject, except that when we fight about the curriculum and what's going to be taught, and those of you who are educators nod because you've seen how the sausage is made, it gets really heated in Austin because the people who care understand the power of the story and the way we tell it. And so how we're going to talk about slavery, how we're going to talk about 1776, how we're going to talk about some of these issues matters.
Or if they just don't talk about it.
Or if we don't talk about it at all, which is another way of teaching by not teaching, because then the story doesn't have all its pieces, right? So yeah. All right. Anything else on that? That makes sense, though. That's an important, I think, takeaway from what God's doing here, the wisdom of how we stay his people, pass on the faith to our children, even keep ourselves growing in the right ways. Makes sense?
The school, or biblically, or change the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
What really has to fit you
more. Well, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's a, you know, turn life into a choose-your-own-adventure book. Those of us of a certain age remember those. Yeah, you get to, you know, make a choice, turn to page 75, and yeah. All right. Those of you who don't, Google it later. All right, let's turn to chapter 5 then. So, moving on, chapter 5, great, one of my favorite actual chapters in the whole story taking. As soon as the kings of all the Amorites, and by the way, I don't know if you've realized this, Amorites, we don't know our Semitic languages, that's okay. Amorites is actually a catch-all term like Canaanites. It's not one ethnic group. Amorites almost means something like Westerners because they were the Western Semitic peoples. It's kind of like we talk about North Americans, and whether you're talking about Canadians, I almost said Canaanites for the Canadians. And I stand by what I said. No. but you know, the Canadians or U.S. citizens or Mexico, you know, just kind of that. So Amorite is kind of a catch-all term. I don't know why I told you that, but now you know. So the kings of the Amorites, all these different ethnic groups, Perizzites, Hivites, Hittites, Jebusites, etc., who were beyond the Jordan to the west. In other words, because that's where Israel is now, right? And all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, that goes all the way over. So that'd be like the Philistines over there, right? They were actually known as the sea peoples. There was five cities along the coast there. So the whole region heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over. And why does that scare them? Well, A, it's a cool miracle in its own right. But what did the Rahab tell them? We've heard your God's done this before too. So they're like, oh boy, what happened to Egypt is... And where is Israel now? Israel is on the west side of the Jordan. And their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, go to war. No, that's not what God does. He does something that, from human standpoints, is completely counterintuitive. He says, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. And a second time in what sense? Well, they haven't been circumcised since they came out of Egypt, so second generation needs to be circumcised. And so Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haaralot. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who had come out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out of had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. And the Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So it was their children whom he raised up in that place that Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. All right. Anybody see this as like an unexpected detour? What makes this unexpected? So first of all, the timing. You know, if God knows I got a bunch of, you know, uncircumcised, you know, people, and he's known this the whole time, when might you have had this conversation with your people? Before coming over. Because what's odd about doing it now? Yeah. And in the midst of the enemy. Unless we doubt this, verse 8, and when the circumcising of the nation was finished, they remained in their places in the camp until they were... Yeah, this is going to be a three-day weekend for them. Right? And by the way, is there another story in the Bible that reminds us of how vulnerable people can be when all the men are cut up? Yeah, Genesis 34. In fact, the Jews may be saying, oh, I feel a bit guilty about that now. Because remember, that's the old story where Shechem, a Canaanite, wants to marry Dinah, the often forgotten daughter of Jacob, after he's already lain with her and thus embarrassed her. And so Simeon and Levi are mad about that. And so they tell the people, Shechem and his city mates, you can marry her if you adopt our custom, and our custom is circumcision. Now, I don't know what kind of clout Shechem had with all his buddies, because when I got married, if I'd said to my groomsmen, hey, guys, I need a favor, that's not happening. But somehow Shechem gets the entire city, per the plan of Simeon and Levi, to do this. And I think you all have heard me tell this story before. I think it's the saddest verse in all the Bible there in Genesis 34. And on the third day, when the men of Shechem were still sore. But that's when Simeon and Levi and their brothers come, and what do? Slaughter them all, as was their plan the whole time. They didn't really care about them getting circumcised and, you know, joining the family, and this is how we do it, so that, you know, the reception will be less awkward. By the way, no more hot dogs. No, it was about making them vulnerable so they could slaughter them. So here we are now, and we're sitting in the midst of a very agitated Canaanite populace. And God says, oh, by the way, before we do anything else, now let's all get out our flint knives and let's circumcise everybody. And by the way, is there one other piece of this? We talked about parallelizing. Yes, there is. Because anybody remember this weird little story in Exodus chapter 4 when Moses is called to be the representative of God's people? He's on his way back to Egypt. Anybody remember this story? What happened? God tries to kill, because Moses has not done what? He failed to circumcise his son. And so the parallels in reverse keep on popping in. Keep on popping in. Now, Anthony, you had a hand or something there.
You know, it reinforces, though, their faith in God.
Well, correct. I think that's the part of the point, too, is, are you going to trust God or not? Because if we get attacked right now, now there's not much of a fight in those men. So that's and I think that's why God did it. You do it on the other side of the Jordan, you know, we don't have to trust in God nearly as much. You do it literally, and again, if you've been there, you know, where Gilgal is relative to where Jericho is. I mean, we're talking a couple of miles, or we're talking visual distance. It's a very flat plain. You're literally doing this inside of the enemy. And nobody's going to be able, until they heal, to do much about it. And that's the whole point, is who's really leading, conquering, protecting, guiding? Well, make yourself very vulnerable and find out. You know, it's a stepping out of the boat moment, very much so. Yes, ma'am.
It makes sure that everybody realizes that God's doing.
Correct. That's exactly right. You have to put your faith in God to do that kind of an act in that kind of a situation with that kind of a timing thing. And then once they've done that, this is, by the way, one of the other reasons. It's also a function of the calendar. Now, we talked last week about the text makes clear, we know they come over on the 10th day of the first month, which means we're right around the corner from what? The 14th day of the first month is? So God is actually doing this exactly on the same part of the calendar when he did it the first time. And one of the other reasons they need to get themselves cleaned up now, pardon the pun, is because no uncircumcised Israelite is allowed to eat the Passover. Which also makes you wonder about what else then have they not been doing? Is there any record of keeping the Passover in the wilderness? Well, that, by the way, will that be something that becomes part of Israel's ongoing history? Yes, it will. You read in the historical books, Hezekiah's day, Hezekiah among his other reforms has them keep the Passover. And what's the text tell us? It's been a long time since they did the Passover. Memorials matter. You ever wonder if maybe they were more devout about their memorials and what they were for and keeping them when they were supposed to and telling their children about it? Maybe they wouldn't have had the history they had. And so, yeah, part of why also the timing then, besides a faith moment, is if we're going to do the Passover in a couple days, we need to actually be properly prepared to do it. And so, also, they circumcise them. And verse 9 summarizes it as well. The Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. And that's why they call the name of the place Gilgal. Because in Hebrew, the name, the word Gilgal, not just transliterated from Hebrew, but Gilgal sounds like Galal, the verb for rolling. And so it's a little bit of a pun intentionally. So in their language, they get the message. The rolling away of the foreskins, the rolling away of the reproach is the idea. And stop and think about it. In what senses is being uncircumcised a reproach of Egypt? Okay. Okay. So just on the moral level, they're not very much reflecting what they should be as God's people. What else? Say again? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, they, if, you know, and this goes back even before the law of Moses, what's the quintessential mark that you are one of Abraham's people? Yeah, and so you know, going all the way back to Genesis 17, when God has Abraham as an aged man, get out his flint knife and do the deed there, because this is the mark for all generations that you are my people. Can you tell the difference between a Jew and an Egyptian anymore? Nope, not in the way it mattered to God. And so it's time to start looking like my people again. And so, yeah, there's on a number of levels this reproach of Egypt. You know, it's God's way of saying, you know, kind of get a haircut, dress nice, and look like what you are. And so the name of that place is Gilgal to this day. And when the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain, and the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. Why? Because God's kept his word. Where are they? In the land. And what did he say? When you get in the land, you're going to eat of vineyards you didn't plant, and you know, you're going to live off other people's work. I mean, and we forget this sometimes. God didn't have them destroy all the cities. They were supposed to drive out the people, but only a handful of cities he actually explicitly said destroy: Jericho, Hazor, Ai. But most cities, they were literally, you'll drive the people out, and you get what they built. And so they begin to live off the good of the land. And the manna ceased, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. And then comes one of my favorite stories in all the Bible. And so now, having cleaned themselves up, made themselves a holy people who looked the part in God's eyes, having kept the Passover, again, as you know, participating in this whole scene that we've been talking about, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes, and behold, a man was standing before him with a drawn sword in his hand, which probably indicates, what, is that an aggressive posture? Yeah, you know, there's something serious going on here. And Joshua went to him, which is not what I would have done, but and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? Whose side are you on? And his answer is, isn't it a great answer? It is a great answer. No, or some of your translations may say neither. Rather, I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. I love that. And that's the thing is, you know, I don't know if you've ever thought about this or connected the dots. This is literally, these verses really ought to be part of chapter 6, because what the text is saying is all those days of them marching around Jericho and doing nothing and then even blowing the horns, who's actually doing the work? Who's really there? Which army counts? The invisible one. Unless you think that's not how God works. Think about a couple other stories from his people's history. Think about 2 Samuel 5, when David is asking God, should I go fight the Philistines or not in one particular situation? And God says, wait till you hear the sound of marching in the treetops. And then you can tag along too. You can follow that, because, but what's he hearing? There the whole time, we just don't get to see it normally. And he didn't see it either, but he got to hear the sound of God. Even if they actually go out and swing swords and stab people and do that, why do they win against overwhelming odds? Yeah. And that, and then my true favorite story in the Bible, I like all these kind of stories, my favorite story in the Bible is in the days of Elisha. Remember, when the king of Syria is hacked off because he's realizing Elisha keeps on telling the king of Israel what all his plans are. And so before I can get rid of the king of Israel, I got to get rid of Elisha. And so he finds out where Elisha is in the city of Dothan. And so he goes overnight and surrounds the city. And Elisha's servant wakes up in the morning and goes out to get the paper and realizes, we're in trouble. And Elisha is... And think about the power of the prayer. He doesn't say, Lord, come and deliver us. He says, open his eyes, which implies what? Already there. Always God's at work. And we're just the ones who are blind and forget that. The army was there the whole time. The army of fire. And so is Elisha worried? No, because he is a prophet. He had a better faith. He knew the whole time, God's got this. We aren't in trouble. It's the Syrians who are in trouble. They just don't know it. Right? And so here we come back to the beginning of these kinds of stories. First time Israel gets this experience. Now I have come. And so who are you? I'm God's general. And so the commander Lord's army said to Joshua, and again, now we're at his burning bush moment, which makes you realize it's not just an angel. It's God. And as a quick sidebar, you know, people always ask, so is the angel of the Lord like the pre-incarnate Christ, or is it? No. I don't think that's the right reading. I think the best we can do, and this is a longer rabbit trail for a different time. He doesn't show up often in the Bible, but when he does show up and people realize they've seen the angel of the Lord, they're often terrified, or in this case, told to take their shoes off or whatever. They realize, I haven't just seen an angel, which is terrifying enough most of the time in the Bible. But they realize they've seen God. And the best I can do with it is, I think the angel of the Lord is an Old Testament way of saying that God dials down the wattage so that he can be seen, but not as he truly is. But angel is not a magical word of always just a type of creature. An angel is just a messenger. Humans are sometimes called angels in the Bible because they just serve as a messenger role. So the word itself describes more of a role. And so, the way I like to describe it is, I think what he's really is, this is an avatar of God, where it's God, but he's dialed down the glory so it doesn't kill you. It'll overwhelm you and rattle you a little bit, but what happens if you ever see God? No man can see my face and live. But do people get to see God in some way in other cases? Yeah. You know, Moses goes up into the cloud on Sinai, right? Comes back, his face is, he's been in the presence of God, but what's God done? Dialed it down enough it didn't kill him. And God can do that. God can adjust the wattage as he will because he's God. That's the perk of being God. And I think this is just a way of the Bible saying, in some not fully comprehensible way, that God has come down in some ways in an avatar-like way, and he's doing what he does. Now, there was a hand. Yeah, Jared.
Yeah, just pointing to that, he accepts his worship.
Yes. That's right. Exactly right. Yeah, normally if an angel, and a classic example is the book of Revelation, when John falls down in front of the angels that's guiding him around, and the angels, you know, you're going to get both of us in trouble. Don't do that. Angels refuse to accept worship, unless you're Satan. And then he actually encourages you to bow down. But anyways, the power of this particular story, even for the people of God, don't ever think God's on your side, right? What's the real takeaway here? Are you on our side or their side? And he says, that's not how this works. And that is such a necessary reminder for us today, I think, as well, especially where religion and politics have mixed in such toxic, toxic ways in our culture. There is no such thing as the right side of history, folks. Talking about a Christian nation, that's not how God looks at this. Quit thinking that God's on the Republican side or the Democrat side. Do different parties and their positions have moral implications? Yeah. But the truth of the matter is, on the day of judgment, do you think there are Republicans in the House of Representatives that are going to hell? Do you think there are Democrats in the House of Representatives that are going to hell? So maybe this is a nonpartisan issue. And we need to remind ourselves of that sometimes. But the truth of the matter is that God cannot be put into a box. Just as what happened when Jesus, God, became flesh and dwelt among us, the truth of the matter is, did he get after the liberals, the Sadducees? Yes, he did. Did he get after the conservatives, the Pharisees? Yes, he did. At the end of the day, what did everybody want of him? Everybody wanted him dead. Because nobody's views escaped critique. Because God is not on anybody's side. He's on his side, and your job is get where he's at. And getting where he's at will almost always break up the lines that we have drawn in our little sandbox of life. Make sense? Some of you, I've read this before, but I still, probably the last politician in this country's history who got this was Lincoln, who in his second inaugural address, literally given 6 weeks before he was assassinated. They did their inaugurations back in the spring, back in those days. They didn't have, you know, internet and instant news access. It took a while to send all the ballots in, count them, send them, you know, anyways. So they used to do it back in March. He gives this speech in March. He's dead in April. The Civil War is just about done. Lee has not officially surrendered to Appomattox yet, but everybody knows we're in the mop-up stage. It's over. And so the North is going to win. And, you know, of course, there were some, and unfortunately with Lincoln being dead, Andrew Johnson was one of them who wanted to pay back hard on the South. And thus the Reconstruction went the way it did. But Lincoln was of a more magnanimous mind. Obviously, through the war, both sides claimed God and the Bible were on their side. You know, you had Southern pastors and preachers claiming, you know, passages that justified the South's cause. You had the same thing going on in the North. But Lincoln would have none of it. Lincoln would have none of it. Well, let's see. For sake of time, because the bell's going to catch us, I don't think I have time to read it all. The whole thing's worth reading. It's not that long. But I am going to pick up with here. Each side, in other words, North and South, each side looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. In other words, either North or South thought it would be this devastating as the past 4 years have been. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. Everyone thinks God's on their side. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of the other men's face, but let us judge not, lest we be not judged. You know, yeah, South's got their sins, but let's be honest, we Northerners do too. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in the living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn by the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. We are all guilty, and that's why this war has happened. Yes, the South held slavery, but as I mentioned before, you forget the North profited off it too with the cheap cotton, which they were happy to use in their textile mills. Everybody had blood on their hands, and Lincoln was the rare politician who was willing to admit no partisanship. We're all guilty, and we all deserve what's happened. All right, see you next week.